Dolly and HM Government for services rendered. Probably a good deal for the girls involved, he was sure. Though Tim's house probably wouldn't spring for shoes in a bag. Tony?
Yeah, Jack?
Wills looked up from his workstation. How do we know if this Solly is a bad guy?
We don't, for sure.
Not until he actually does something, or we intercept a conversation between him and somebody we don't like.
So, I'm just checking this bird out.
Correct. You'll be doing a lot of that.
Any feel for the guy yet?
He's a horny son of a bitch.
It's hard to be rich and single, in case you haven't noticed, Junior.
Jack blinked.
Maybe he had that coming.
Okay, but I'll be damned if I pay for it, and he's paying a lot.
What else? Wills asked.
He doesn't talk a hell of a lot.
What's that tell you?
Ryan sat back in his swivel chair to think it over. He didn't talk to his girlfriends much either, at least not about his new job. As soon as you said financial management, most women tended to doze off in self-defense.
Did that mean anything?
Maybe Solly just wasn't a talker. Maybe he was sufficiently secure that he didn't feel the need to impress his lady friends with anything but his cash. He always used cash, not credit cards.
And why that?
To keep his family from knowing?
Well, Jack didn't talk to Mom and Dad about his love life either. In fact, he rarely took a girlfriend to the family home. His mom tended to scare girls away.
Not his dad, strangely enough.
The M.D., Dr. Ryan, struck other women as powerful, and while most young women found it admirable, many also found it intimidating as hell. His father dialed all the power stuff way back and came off as a slender and distinguished gray-haired teddy bear to family guests. More than anything else, his dad liked to play catch with his son on the grass overlooking the Chesapeake Bay, maybe hearkening back to a simpler time. He had Kyle for that. The littlest Ryan was still in grammar school, at the stage where he asked furtive questions about Santa Claus, but only when Mom and Dad weren't around. There was probably a kid in class who wanted to let everybody know what he knew. There was always one of those, and Katie had wised up by now. She still liked to play Barbies, but she knew that her mom and dad bought them at the Toys R Us in Glen Burnie and assembled the accoutrement on Christmas Eve, a process his father truly loved, much as he might bitch about it. When you stop believing in Santa Claus, the whole damn world just started a downhill slide.
It tells us he's not a talker. Not much else, Jack said after a moment's reflection. We're not supposed to convert inference into facts, are we?
Correct. A lot of other people think otherwise, but not here. Assumption is the mother of all fuck-ups. That shrink at Langley specializes in spinning. He's good, but you need to learn to distinguish between speculation and facts.
So, tell me about Mr. Solly, Wills commanded.
He's horny, and he doesn't talk very much. He plays very conservatively with the family's money.
Anything that makes him look like a bad guy?
No, but he's worth watching because of his religious... well, extremism's the wrong word. There are some things missing here. He's not boisterous, not showy the way rich people his age usually are.
Who started the file on him? Jack asked.
The Brits did.
Something about this guy tweaked the interest of one of their senior analysts.
Then Langley took a brief look and started a file of their own. Then he was intercepted talking to a guy who's also got a file at Langley. The conversation wasn't about anything important, but there it was, Wells explained.
And you know, it's a lot easier to open a file than it is to close one.
His cell phone is coded into the NSA computers, and so they report on him whenever he turns it on.
I've been through the file, too. He's worth keeping an eye on, I think, but I'm not sure why.
You learn to trust your instincts in this business, Jack. So, I'm nominating you to be the in-house expert on this kid.
And I'm looking for how he handles his money. That's right. You know, it doesn't take much to finance a bunch of terrorists. At least not much by his reckoning. $1 million a year is a lot of money to those people. They live hand to mouth, and their maintenance expenses aren't that high. So you're supposed to look at the margins. Chances are he'll try to hide whatever he does in the shadows of his big transactions. I'm not an accountant, Jack pointed out. His father had gotten a CPA a long time ago, but never used it, even to do his own taxes. He had a law firm for that. Can you do arithmetic? Well, yeah. So? Attach a nose to it. Oh, great, John Patrick Ryan Jr. thought. Then he reminded himself that actual intelligence operations weren't about shoot the bad guy and bang Ursula Undress while the credits rolled. That was only in the movies. This was the real world. Our friend is in that much of a hurry? Ernesto asked in considerable surprise.
So it would seem. The Norte Americanos have been hard on them of late. I imagine they want to remind their enemies that they still have fangs.
A thing of honor for them, perhaps, Pablo speculated. His friend would understand that readily enough.
So, what do we do now?
When they are settled in Mexico City, we arrange for transport into America, and I presume we arrange for weapons.
Complications?
If the Norte Americanos have our organizations penetrated, they might have some pre-warning plus whispers of our involvement, but we have considered this already.
They'd considered it briefly, yes, Ernesto reflected, but that had been at a convenient distance. Now the knocker on the door was rattling, and it was time for further reflection, but he couldn't renege on this deal. That, too, was a matter both of honor and of business. They were preparing an initial shipment of cocaine to the EU. That promised to be a really sizable market.
How many people are coming?
14, he says. They have no weapons at all.
What will they need, do you suppose?
Light automatic should do it, plus pistols, of course, Pablo said. We have a supplier in Mexico who can handle it for less than $10,000. For an additional 10, we can have the weapons delivered to the end users in America to avoid complications during the crossing.
Bueno, make it so.
Will you fly to Mexico yourself?
Pablo nodded.
Tomorrow morning. I will coordinate with them and the coyotes this first time.
You will be careful, Ernesto pointed out.
His suggestions had the force of an explosive device. Pablo took some chances, but his services were very important to the cartel. He would be hard to replace.
Of course, Efe. I need to evaluate how reliable these people are if they are to assist us in Europe.
Yes, that is so, Ernesto agreed warily.
As with most deals, when it came time to take action, there were second thoughts. But he was not an old woman. He had never been afraid to act decisively.
The Airbus pulled up to its gate. The first-class passengers were allowed to deplane first, and they followed the colored arrows on the floor to Immigration and Customs, where they assured the uniformed bureaucrats that they had nothing to declare, and their passports were duly stamped, and they walked off to collect their luggage. The leader of the group was named Mustafa. A Saudi by birth, he was clean-shaven, which he didn't like, though it exposed skin that the women seemed to like. He and a colleague named Abdullah walked together to get their bags, and then out to where their rides were supposed to be waiting. This would be the first test of their newfound friends in the Western Hemisphere. Sure enough, someone was holding a cardboard square with Miguel printed on it. That was Mustafa's code name for this mission, and he walked over to shake the man's hand. The greeter said nothing, but motioned them to follow him. Outside, a brown Plymouth minivan waited. The bags went in back, and the passengers slid into the middle seat. It was warm in Mexico City,
and the air was fouler than anything they'd ever experienced. What ought to have been a sunny day was ruined by a gray blanket over the city. Air pollution, Mustafa thought. The driver continued to say nothing as he drove them to their hotel. This actually impressed them. If there was nothing to say, then one should keep quiet. The hotel was a good one, as expected. Mustafa checked in using the false visa card that had been faxed ahead, and in 5 minutes he and his friend were in their spacious room on the fifth floor. They looked around for obvious bugs before speaking. "I didn't think that damned flight would ever end," Abdullah groused, looking in the minibar for bottled water. They'd been briefed to be careful drinking the stuff that came out of the tap. "Yes, I agree. How did you sleep?"
"Not well. I thought the one good thing about alcohol was that it made you unconscious."
"For some, not for all," Mustafa told his friend.
"There are other drugs for that."
"Those are hateful to God," Abdullah observed, "unless a physician administers them."
"We have friends now who do not think that way."
"Infidels,"
Abdullah almost spat.
"The enemy of your enemy is your friend."
Abdullah twisted the top off an Evian bottle.
"No. You can trust a true friend."
"Can we trust these men?"
"Only as far as we must," Mustafa allowed.
Muhammad had been careful in his mission brief. These new allies would help them only as a matter of convenience, because they also wished to harm the great Satan. That was good enough for now. Someday these allies would become enemies, and they'd have to deal with them. But that day had not yet come. He stifled a yawn. Time to get some rest. Tomorrow would be a busy day. Jack lived in a condo in Baltimore, a few blocks from Orioles Park at Camden Yards, where he had season tickets, but which was dark tonight because the Orioles were in Toronto. Not a good cook. He ate out, as he usually did, alone this time because he didn't have a date, which was not as unusual as he might have wished. Finished, he walked back to his condo, switched on his TV, and then thought better of it, went to his computer instead, and logged on to check his email and surf the net. That's when he made a note to himself. Sally lived alone as well, and while he often had whores for company, it wasn't every night. What did he do on the other nights? Log on to his computer? A lot of people did. Did the Brits have a tap on his phone lines? They must. But the file on Sally didn't include any emails. Why? Something worth checking out. "What are you thinking, Aldo?" Dominic asked his brother. ESPN had a baseball game on. The Mariners were playing the Yankees, to the current detriment of the former. "I'm not sure I like the idea of shooting some poor bastard down on the street, bro." "What if you know he's a bad guy? And what if I whacked the wrong guy just because he drives the same kind of car and has the same mustache? What if he leaves a wife and kids behind? Then I'm a fucking murderer. A contract killer at that. That's not the sort of thing they taught us at basic school, you know?" "But if you know he's a bad guy, then what?" the FBI agent asked. "Hey, Enzo, that's not what they trained you to do either." "I know that, but this here's a different situation. If I know the mutt's a terrorist, and I know we can't arrest him, and I know he's got more plans, then I think I can handle it. Out in the hills, in Afghanistan, you know, our intel wasn't always gold-plated, man. Sure, I learned to put my own ass on the line, but not some poor other schlubs. The people you were after over there, who'd they kill?" "Hey, they were part of an organization that made war on the United States of America. They probably weren't Boy Scouts, but I never saw any direct evidence of it." "What if you had?" Dominic asked. "But I didn't."
"You're lucky," Enzo responded, remembering a little girl whose throat had been slashed ear to ear.
There was a legal adage that hard cases made for bad law. but the books could not anticipate all the things that people did. Black ink on white paper was a little too dry for the real world sometimes. But he'd always been the passionate one of the two. Brian had always been a touch cooler, like Fonzie on Happy Days. Twins, yes, but fraternal ones. Dominic was more like his father, Italian and passionate. Brian had turned out more like Mom, chillier from a more northerly climate. To an outsider, the differences might have appeared less than trivial, but to the twins themselves, it was frequently the subject of jabs and jokes. When you see it, Brian, when it's right there in front of you, it sets you off, man. It lights a fire in the gut. Hey, been there, done that, got the t-shirt, okay? I whacked 5 men all by myself, but it was business, not personal. They tried to ambush us, but they didn't read the manual right. And I used fire and maneuver to fake them out and roll them up, just like they taught me to do. It's not my fault they were inept. They could have surrendered, but they preferred to shoot it out. That was a bad call on their part, but a man should do what he thinks is best. His all-time favorite movie was John Wayne's Hondo. Hey, Aldo, I'm not saying you're a wuss. I know what you're saying, but look, I don't want to turn into one of them, okay? That's not the mission here, bro. I got my doubts too, but I'm going to stay around and see how it plays out. We can kiss it off whenever we want, I suppose. Then Derek Jeter doubled up the middle. Pitchers probably thought of him as a terrorist, didn't they? On the other side of the building, Pete Alexander was on a secure phone to Columbia, Maryland. So, how are they doing? He heard Sam Granger ask. Pete sipped at his glass of sherry. They're good kids. They both have doubts. The Marine talks openly about it. And the FBI guy keeps his mouth shut about it, but the wheels are turning over slowly. How serious is it? Hard to say. Hey, Sam, we always knew that training would be the hard part. Few Americans want to grow up to be professional killers, at least not the ones we need for this. There was a guy at the agency who would have fit right in. But he's too damn old and you know it, Alexander countered at once. Besides, he has his sunset job just across the pond in Wales, and he seems to be comfortable in it. If only your aunt had balls, she'd be your uncle, Pete pointed out. Selecting candidates is your job. Getting them trained up is mine. These two have the brains, and they have the skills. The hard part is temperament. I'm working on that. Be patient. In the movies, it's a lot easier. In the movies, everybody is borderline psychopath. Is that who we want on the payroll? I guess not. There were plenty of psychopaths to be found. Every large police department knew of several. And they'd kill people for modest monetary considerations or a small quantity of drugs. The problem with such people was that they didn't take orders well, and they were not very smart. Except in the movies. Where was that little Nikita girl when you really needed her? So, we have to deal with good, reliable people who have brains. Such people think, and they do not always think predictably, do they? A guy with a conscience is nice to have, but every so often he's going to wonder if he's doing the right thing. Why did you have to send 2 Catholics? Jews are bad enough. They're born with guilt. But Catholics learn it all in school. Thank you, Your Holiness, Granger responded, deadpan. Sam, we knew going in that this was not going to be easy. Jesus, you send me a Marine and an FBI agent. Why not a couple of Eagle Scouts, you know? Okay, Pete, it's your job. Any idea on timing? There's some work piling up on us, Granger observed. Maybe a month. And I'll know if they'll play or not. They will need to know the why in addition to the who, but I always told you that, Alexander reminded his boss. True, Granger admitted. It really was a lot easier in the movies, wasn't it? Just let your fingers do the walking to Assassins R Us in the Yellow Pages. They had thought about hiring former KGB officers at first. They all had expert training, and all wanted money. The going rate was less than $25,000 per kill, a pittance. But such people would probably report back to Moscow Center in the hope of being rehired, and the campus would then become known within the global black community. They couldn't have that. "What about the new toys?" Pete asked. Sooner or later, he'd have to train the twins with the new tools of the trade. 2 weeks, they tell me.
That long? Hell, Sam, I proposed them 9 months ago.
It's not something you get at the local Western Auto. They have to be manufactured from scratch. You know, highly skilled machinists in out-of-the-way places, people who don't ask questions.
I told you, get guys who do this sort of thing for the Air Force. They're always making up clever little gadgets.
Like tape recorders that fit in cigarette lighters. Now, that was probably inspired by the movies. And for the really good things, the government almost never had the right people in-house, which was why they employed civilian contractors who took the money, did the job, and kept their mouths shut because they wanted more such contracts. They're all being worked on, Pete. 2 weeks, he emphasized.
Roger that. Until then, I have all the suppressed pistols I need.
They're both doing nicely with the tracking and tailing drills. Helps that they're so ordinary-looking.
So, bottom line.
Things are going well? Granger asked.
Except for the conscience thing?
Yeah.
Okay, keep me posted.
Will do.
See ya.
Alexander set the receiver back down.
Goddamn consciences, he thought. It would be nice to have robots, but somebody might notice Robbie striding down the street. And they couldn't have that.
Or maybe the Invisible Man, but in the H.G. Wells story, the drug that made him transparent also made him mad, and this gig was already crazy enough, wasn't it? He tossed off the last of his sherry, and then, on reflection, went off to refill his glass.
Chapter 8. Conviction. Mustafa and Abdullah arose at dawn, said their morning prayers, and ate, and then hooked up their computers and checked their email. Sure enough, Mustafa had an email from Mohammed, forwarding a message from someone else, supposedly named Diego, with instructions for a meeting at 10:30 a.m. local time. He sorted through the rest of his electronic mail. Most of it something the Americans called spam. He'd learned that this was a canned pig product, which seemed entirely appropriate. Both of them walked outside, but separately, just after 9, mainly to get the blood moving and examine the neighborhood. They checked carefully but furtively for tails, and found none. They got to the planned rendezvous point at 10:25. Diego was already there, reading a paper, wearing a white shirt with blue stripes.
"Diego?" Mustafa asked pleasantly.
"You must be Miguel," the contact replied with a smile, rising to shake hands. "Please be seated."
Pablo scanned around. Yes, there was Miguel's backup, sitting alone and ordering coffee, doing overwatch like a professional.
"So how do you like Mexico City?"
"I did not know it was so large and bustling," Mustafa waved around. "The sidewalks were crowded with people heading in all directions, and the air is so foul."
"That is a problem here. The mountains hold in the pollution. It takes strong winds to clear the air."
"So, coffee?" Mustafa nodded. Pablo waved to the waiter and held up the coffee pot. The sidewalk cafe was European in character, but not overly crowded. The tables were about half occupied, in knots of people meeting for business or socially, doing their talking and minding their own business. The new coffee pot arrived. Mustafa poured and waited for the other to speak.
"So, what can I do for you?"
"All of us are here as requested. How soon can we go?"
How soon do you wish?
Pablo asked.
This afternoon would be fine, but that might be a little too soon for your arrangements.
Yes, but what about tomorrow, say about 1300 hours?
That would be excellent, Mustafa responded in pleasant surprise. How will the crossing be arranged?
I will not be directly involved, you understand, but you will be driven to the border and handed over to someone who specializes in getting people and certain goods into America. You will be required to walk about 6 kilometers. It will be warm, but not greatly so. Once in America, you will be driven to a safe house outside Santa Fe, New Mexico. There you can either fly to your final destinations or rent cars.
Weapons?
What exactly will you require?
Ideally, we should like AK-47s.
Pablo shook his head at once. Those we cannot supply, but we can get you Uzi and Ingram submachine guns. 9mm parabellum caliber, with, say, 6 30-round magazines each, fully loaded for your purposes.
More ammunition, Mustafa said at once. 12 magazines, plus 3 additional boxes of ammunition for each weapon.
Pablo nodded. That is easily done.
The increased expense would be only a couple of $1,000. The weapons would have been bought on the open market, along with the ammunition. They were technically traceable to their origin and or purchaser, but that was only a theoretical problem, not a practical one. The guns would be mainly Ingrams, not the better-made and more accurate Israeli Uzis, but these people wouldn't care. Who knows? They might even have religious or moral objections to touching a Jewish-made weapon.
Tell me, how are you set for traveling expenses?
We have $5,000 each in cash.
You can use that for minor expenses like food and gasoline, but for other things you need credit cards. Americans will not accept cash to rent cars, and never to buy airplane tickets.
We have them, Mustafa replied. He and each member of the team had Visa cards issued to them in Bahrain. They even had consecutive numbers. All were drawn on an account in a Swiss bank, whose account held just over $500,000, sufficient to their purposes. The name on the card Pablo saw was John Peter Smith.
Good.
Whoever had set this up hadn't made the mistake of using explicitly Middle Eastern names. Just as long as the card didn't fall into the hands of a police officer who might ask Mr. Smith where exactly he came from. He hoped they had been briefed on the American police and their habits.
Other documents? Pablo asked.
Our passports are Qatari. We have international driver's licenses. We all speak acceptable English and can read maps. We know about American laws. We will keep within the speed limits and drive carefully. The nail that sticks up is hammered down, so we will not stick up.
Good, Pablo observed.
So they had been briefed. Some might even remember it. Remember that one mistake can ruin the entire mission for all of you, and it is easy to make mistakes. America is an easy country in which to live and move about, but their police are very efficient. If you are not noticed, you are safe from them. Therefore, you must avoid being noticed. Fail in that, and you could all be doomed to failure.
Diego, we will not fail, Mustafa promised.
Fail at what? Pablo wondered, but did not ask. How many women and children will you kill? But it didn't really matter to him. It was a cowardly way to kill, but the rules of honor in his friend's culture were very different from his own. This was business, and that was all he needed to know. 3 miles, push-ups, and a coffee chaser, and that was life in Southern Virginia.
Brian, you're used to carrying a firearm?
Usually an M16 and 5 or 6 extra mags. So
Some fragmentation grenades, too, go in the basic load. Yeah, Pete. I was talking about sidearms, actually. M9 Beretta, that's what I'm used to. Any good with it? It's in my package, Pete. I qualified expert at Quantico, but so did most of my class. No big deal. You used to carrying it around? You mean in civilian clothes? No. Okay, get used to it. Is it legal? Brian asked. Virginia is a shall-issue state. If you've got a clean record, the Commonwealth will grant you a concealed carry permit. What about you, Dominic? I'm still FBI, Pete. I'd feel kind of naked out on the street without a friend. What do you carry? Smith & Wesson 1076. Shoots the 10mm cartridge double action. The Bureau's gone to the Glock lately, but I like the Smith better. And no, I didn't carve a notch in the grips, he didn't add. Though he had thought about it. Okay, well, when you're off campus here, I want you both to carry. Just to get used to the idea, Brian. A shrug. Fair enough. It beat the hell out of a 65-pound rucksack. There was a lot more to it than just Solly, of course. Jack was working on a total of 11 different people, all but one of them Middle Eastern, all in the money business. The one European lived in Riyadh. He was German, but had converted to Islam, which had struck someone as odd enough to deserve electronic surveillance. Jack's university German was good enough to read the guy's emails, but they didn't reveal very much. He'd evidently gone native in his habits, didn't even drink beer. He was evidently popular with his Saudi friends. One thing about Islam was that if you obeyed the rules and prayed the correct way, they didn't much care what you looked like. It would have been admirable, except for the fact that most of the world's terrorists prayed to Mecca. But that, Jack reminded himself, wasn't the fault of Islam. The night he himself had been born, people had tried to kill him while he was still in his mother's womb, and they'd identified themselves as Catholics. Fanatics were fanatics, the world around. The idea that people had tried to murder his mother was enough to make him want to pick his Beretta 40. His father? Well, his dad was able to look after himself, but messing with women constituted a big step over the line, and that was a line you could cross only once and in one direction. There was no coming back. He didn't remember any of it, of course. The ULA terrorists had all gone off to meet their god, courtesy of the state of Maryland, before he'd entered first grade, and his parents had never talked about it. His sister Sally had, though. She still had dreams about it. He wondered if Mom and Dad had them, too. Did events like that go away eventually? He'd seen things on the History Channel to suggest that World War II veterans still had images of combat returned to them at night, and that had been over 60 years ago. Such memories had to be a curse. Tony?
Yeah, Junior?
This guy Otto Weber, what's the big deal? He's about as exciting as vanilla ice cream. If you're a bad guy, do you suppose you wear a neon sign on your back, or do you think you try to hide down in the grass?
With the snakes, Junior completed the thought.
I know. We're looking for little things. Like I told you, you can do fourth grade arithmetic, attach a nose to it. And yes, you're looking for things that are supposed to be damn near invisible, okay? And that's why this job is so much fun. And innocent little things are mostly innocent little things. If he downloads kiddie porn off the net, it's not because he's a terrorist. It's because he's a pervert. That's not a capital offense in most countries. I bet it is in Saudi. Probably, but they don't chase after it, I bet. I thought they were all Puritans. Over there, a man keeps his libido to himself. But if you do something with a real live kid, you're in big trouble. Saudi Arabia is a good place to abide by the law. You can park your Mercedes and leave the keys in the ignition, and the car will be there when you get back. You can't even do that in Salt Lake City.
Been there? Jack asked.
4 times. The people are friendly as long as you treat them properly. And if you make a real friend over there, he's a friend for life. But their rules are different. And the price for breaking them can be pretty steep. So, Otto Weber plays by the rules. Wills nodded. Correct. He's bought all the way into the system, religion and all. They like him for that. Religion is the center of their culture. When a guy converts and lives by Islamic rules, it validates their world, and they like that, just like anybody would. I don't think Otto's a player, though. The people we're looking for are sociopaths. They can happen anywhere. Some cultures catch them early and change them, or kill them. Some cultures don't. We're not as good at that as we ought to be, and I suspect the Saudis probably are. But the really good ones can skate in any culture, and some of them use the disguise of religion. Islam is not a belief system for psychopaths, but it can be perverted to the use of such people, just like Christianity can. Ever take psych courses? No. Wish I had, Ryan admitted. So, buy some books. Read them. Find people who know about that stuff and ask questions. Listen to the answers. Wills turned back to his computer screen. Shit, Junior thought. This job just kept getting worse. How long, he wondered, before they expected him to turn up something useful? A month? A year? What the hell was a passing grade at the campus? And what exactly would happen when he did turn up something useful? Back to Otto Weber. They couldn't stay in their room all day without having people wonder why. Mustafa and Abdullah left just after eating a light lunch in the coffee shop and took a walk. 3 blocks away, they found an art museum. Admission was free, but inside they found out why. It was a museum of modern art, and its painting and sculpture were well beyond their comprehension. They wandered through it over a period of 2 hours, and both of them concluded that paint must be cheap in Mexico. Nevertheless, it gave them the chance to burnish their covers as they pretended to appreciate the garbage hanging on the walls and sitting on the floors. Then they strolled back to their hotel. The one good thing was the weather. It was warm to those of European extraction, but quite pleasant to the visiting Arabs, gray haze and all. Tomorrow they would see desert again. One last time, perhaps. It was impossible, even for a well-supported government agency, to search all the messages that flew through cyberspace every night, and so the NSA used computer programs to screen for key phrases. The electronic addresses of some known or suspected terrorists or suspected stringers had been identified over the years, and these were watched, as were the server computers of Internet Service Providers, or ISPs. All in all, it used up vast amounts of storage space, and as a result, delivery trucks were constantly bringing new disk storage devices to Fort Meade, Maryland, where they were hooked up to the mainframe computers, so that if a target person was identified, then his emails dating back for months or even years could be screened. If there were ever a game of Falcon and Mouse, this was it. The bad guys, of course, knew that the screening program looked for specific words or phrases, and so they had taken to using their own code words, which was another trap in itself, since code words gave a false sense of security, one that was easily exploited by an agency with 70 years of experience reading the minds of America's enemies. The process had its limits. Too free a use of signal intelligence information revealed its existence, causing the targets to change their methods of encryption and so compromising the source. Using it too little, on the other hand, was as bad as not having it at all. Unfortunately, the intelligence services leaned more to the latter than the former. The creation of a new Department of Homeland Security had, theoretically, set up a central clearinghouse for all threat-related information, but the size of the new super agency had crippled it from the get-go. The information was all there, but in too great a quantity to be processed, and with too many processors to turn out a viable product. But old habits died hard. The intelligence community remained intact, a superagency overtop its own bureaucracy or not, and its segments talked to each other. As always, they savored what the insiders knew, as opposed to those who knew it not, and wished to keep it that way. The National Security Agency's principal means of communication with Central Intelligence Agency was essentially to say, "This is interesting. What do you think?" That was because each of the two agencies held a different corporate ethos. They talked differently. They thought differently. And insofar as they acted at all, they acted differently. But at least they thought in parallel directions, not divergent ones. On the whole, CIA had the better analysts, and NSA was better at gathering information. There were exceptions to both general rules, and in both cases, the really talented individuals knew one another, and among themselves, they mostly spoke the same language. That became clear the next morning with the interagency cable traffic. A senior analyst at Fort Meade headed it as flash traffic to his counterpart at Langley. That ensured that it would be noticed at the campus. Jerry Round saw it at the top of his morning email pile, and he brought it to the next morning's conference. "We will sting them badly this time," the guy says. "What could that mean?" Jerry Rounds wondered aloud. Tom Davis had overnighted in New York. He had a breakfast meeting with the bond people at Morgan Stanley. It was annoying when business got in the way of business. "How good's the translation?" Jerry Henley asked. "The footnote says there's no problem on that end. The intercept is clear and static-free. It's a simple declarative sentence in literate Arabic. No particular nuances to worry about," Rounds declared. "Origin and recipient?" Henley went on. "The originator is a guy named Fa'ad. Last name unknown. We know this guy. We think he's one of their mid-level operations people, a plans rather than field guy. He's based somewhere in Bahrain. He only talks on his cell phone when he's in a moving car or a public place, like a market or something. Nobody's gotten a line on him yet. The recipient," Bell went on, "is supposedly a new guy. More likely an old guy on a newly cloned phone. It's an old analog phone, and so they couldn't generate a voice print." "So they probably have an operation running," Henley observed. "Looks that way," Rounds agreed. "Nature and location, unknown. So, we don't know Dick." Henley reached for his coffee cup and managed a frown best measured on the Richter scale. "What are they going to do about it?" Granger took that one. "Nothing useful, Jerry. They're in a logic trap. If they do anything at all, like upgrading the color on the threat rainbow, they're sounding the alarm. And they've done that so much that it's become counterproductive. Unless they disclose the text and the source, nobody'll take it seriously. If they do disclose anything, we burn the source for fair. And if they don't sound the alarm, Congress will shove whatever ends up happening right up their ass." Elected officials were much more comfortable being the problem rather than the solution. There was political hay to be made from non-productive screaming. So CIA and other services would continue to work at identifying the people with the distant cell phones. That was unglamorous, slow police work, and it ran at a speed that grossly impatient politicians could not dictate. And throwing money at the problem didn't make it any better, which was doubly frustrating to people who didn't know how to do anything else. So, they straddle the issue and do something they know won't work. "And hope for a miracle," Granger agreed with his boss. Police departments all across America would be alerted, of course, but for what purpose and against what threat, nobody knew. And cops were always looking for Middle Eastern faces to pull over and question anyway, to the point that cops were bored with what was almost always a non-productive exercise in doing something the ACLU was already raising hell about. There were six driving while Arab cases pending in various federal district courts, 4 involving physicians, and 2 with demonstrably innocent students whom the local police had hassled a little too vigorously. Whatever case law resulted from those incidents would do far more harm than good. It was just what Sam Granger called it, a logic trap. Henley's frown got a little deeper. It was echoed, he was sure, at a half-dozen government agencies, which, for all their funding and personnel, were about as useful as tits on a boar hog. "Anything we can do?" he asked. "Stay alert and call the cops if we see anything unusual," Granger answered. "Unless you have a gun handy. To shoot some innocent clown who's probably taking citizenship classes," Bell added. "Not worth the trouble." I should have stayed in the Senate, Henley thought. At least being part of the problem had its satisfactions. It was good for the spleen to vent it once in a while. Screaming here was totally counterproductive, and bad for the morale of his people. "Okay, then. We pretend we're ordinary citizens," the boss said at last. The senior staff nodded agreement and went on to the remaining routine business of the day. Toward the end, Henley asked Rounds how the new boy was doing. "He's smart enough to ask a lot of questions. I have him reviewing known or suspected stringers for unaccountable money transfers." "If he can stand doing that, God bless him," Bell observed. "That can drive a man crazy." "Patience is a virtue," Jerry noted. "It's just a son of a bitch to acquire." "We alert all of our people to this intercept?"
"Might as well," Bell responded.
"Done," Granger told them all.
"Shit," Jack observed 15 minutes later. "What's it mean?"
"We might know tomorrow, next week, or never," Wills answered.
"Fa'ad. I know that name."
Jack turned back to his computer and keyed up some files.
"Yeah. He's the guy in Bahrain. How come the local cops haven't sweated him some?
They don't know about him yet. Tracking him's an NSA gig so far, but maybe Langley will see if they can learn some more about him. Are they as good as the FBI for police work?"
"Actually, no, they're not. Different training. But it's not that removed from what a normal person can do."
Ryan the Younger cut him off.
"Bullshit. Reading people is something cops are good at. It's an acquired skill. And you also have to learn how to ask questions."
"Says who?" Wills demanded.
"Mike Brennan. He was my bodyguard. He taught me a lot."
"Well, a good spook has to read people, too. Their asses depend on it."
"Maybe, but if you want your eyes fixed, you talk to my mom. For ears, you talk to somebody else."
"Okay, maybe so. For now, check out our friend Fa'ad." Jack turned back to his computer. He scrolled back to the first interesting conversation they'd intercepted. Then he thought better of it and went back to the very beginning, the first time he'd attracted notice.
Why doesn't he change phones?
Maybe he's lazy. These guys are smart, but they have blind spots, too. They fall into habits. They're clever, but they do not have formal training, like a trained spook, KGB, or like that. NSA had a large but covert listening post in Bahrain, covered in the American embassy, and supplemented by U.S. Navy warships that called there on a regular basis, but were not seen as an electronic threat in that environment. The NSA teams that regularly sailed on them even intercepted people walking the waterfront with their cell phones.
"This guy is dirty," he observed a minute later. "This guy's a bad guy, sure as hell.
He's been a good barometer, too. He says a lot of things we find interesting.
So somebody ought to pick him up."
"They're thinking about that at Langley.
How big's the station in Bahrain?"
6 people. Station chief, 2 field spooks, and 3 sundry employees, signals and stuff."
"That's all? There? Just a handful?"
"That's right," Wills confirmed.
Damn. I used to ask Dad about this. He usually shrugged and grumbled.
He tried pretty hard to get CIA more funding and more employees. Congress wasn't always accommodating.
Have we ever taken a guy up and, you know, talked to him?
Not lately.
Why not?
Manpower, Wills answered simply. Funny thing about employees, they all expect to be paid. We're not that big.
So why doesn't CIA ask the local cops to pick him up?
Bahrain's a friendly country.
Friendly, but not a vassal.
They have their ideas about civil rights, too, just not the same as ours. Also, you can't pick a guy up for what he knows and what he thinks, only for what he's done. As you can see, we don't know that he's actually done anything. So, put a tail on his ass.
And how can CIA do that with only two field spooks? Wills asked.
Jesus. Welcome to the real world, Junior. The agency ought to have recruited some agents, maybe cops in Bahrain, to help out with such tasks, but that hadn't happened yet. The station chief could also have requested more people, of course, but Arabic-speaking and looking field officers were a little thin over at Langley, and those they had went to more obviously troublesome postings. The rendezvous took place as planned. There were three vehicles, each with a driver who spoke scarcely a word, and that in Spanish. The drive was pleasant and distantly reminiscent of home. The driver was cautious. He didn't speed or do anything else to attract attention, but they moved right along in any case. Nearly all of the Arabs smoked cigarettes, and exclusively American brands like Marlboro. Mustafa did as well, and wondered, as had Mohammed before him, what the Prophet would have said about cigarettes. Probably nothing good, but he hadn't said anything, had he? And so Mustafa could smoke as much as he wished. The issues of danger to his health was a distant concern now, after all. He expected to live another 4 or 5 days, but little more than that, if things went according to plan. He'd expected some excited chattering from his people, but there was none. Hardly anyone spoke a word. They just looked blankly out of the passing countryside, speeding past a culture about which they knew little, and they would not learn more.
Okay, Brian, here's your carry permit. Pete Alexander handed it over.
It might as well have been a second driver's license, and it went into his wallet.
So, I'm street legal now?
As a practical matter, no cop is going to hassle a Marine officer for carrying a pistol, concealed or not. But better to dot the I's and cross the T's.
You're going to carry the Beretta?
It's what I'm used to, and the 15 rounds make for security.
What am I supposed to carry it in?
Use one of these, Aldo, Dominic said, holding up his fanny pack. It looked like a money belt, or the kind of pouch used more often by women than by men. A pull on the string ripped it open and revealed the pistol and two extra magazines. A lot of agents use this. More comfortable than a hip holster. Those can dig into your kidneys on a long car ride. For the moment, Brian would tuck it into his belt.
Where to today, Pete?
Back to the mall. More tracking drills.
Great, Brian responded.
Why don't you have invisibility pills?
H.G. Wells took the formula with him.
Chapter 9 Going with God. Jack's drive to the campus took about 35 minutes, listening to NPR's morning edition all the way because, like his father, he didn't listen to contemporary music. The similarities with his dad had both vexed and fascinated John Patrick Ryan, Jr. throughout his life. Through most of his teenage years, he'd fought them off, trying to establish his own identity in contrast to his button-down father. But then in college, he had somehow drifted back, hardly even noticing the process. He thought he was just doing the sensible thing, for instance, to date girls who might be good wife candidates, though he'd never quite found the perfect one. This he unconsciously judged by his mom.
He'd been annoyed by his teachers at Georgetown who said he was a chip off the old block, and at first taken some offense at it, then reminded himself that his father wasn't all that bad a guy. He could have done worse. He'd seen a lot of rebellion, even at a university as conservative as G-Town, with its Jesuit traditions and rigorous scholarship. Some of his classmates had even made a show of rejecting their parents. But what asshole would do something like that? However staid and old-fashioned his father surely was, he'd been a pretty good dad, as dads went. He'd never been overbearing, and let him go his own way and choose his own path. In confidence that he'd turn out okay, Jack wondered. But no. If his father had been that conspiratorial, Jack would have noticed, surely. He thought about conspiracy. There had been a lot of that in the newspapers and pulp book media. His father had even joked more than once about having the Marine Corps paint his personal helicopter black. That would have been a hoot, Jack thought. Instead, his surrogate father had been Mike Brennan, whom he'd regularly bombarded with questions, most of them about conspiracy. He'd been hugely disappointed to learn that the United States Secret Service was 100% confident that Lee Harvey Oswald had assassinated Jack Kennedy and all by himself. At their academy at Beltsville, outside Washington, Jack had held and even shot a replica of the 6.5-millimeter Mannlicher Carcano rifle that had taken the former president's life, and been fully briefed on the case. To his own satisfaction, if not that of the conspiracy industry that so fervently and commercially believed otherwise. The latter had even proposed that his father, as a former CIA official, had been the final beneficiary of a conspiracy that had gone on for at least 50 years for the express purpose of giving CIA the reins of government. Yeah, sure. Like the Trilateral Commission and the World Order of Freemasons, and whoever else the fiction writers could make up. From both his father and Mike Brennan, he'd heard a lot of CIA stories, few of which bragged on the competence of that federal agency. It was pretty good, but nowhere near as competent as Hollywood proposed. But Hollywood probably believed that Roger Rabbit was real. After all, his picture had made money, right? No. The CIA had a couple of profound shortcomings. And was the campus a means of correcting them? That was a question. Damn, Junior thought, turning onto Route 29. Maybe the conspiracy theorists might be right after all. His own internal answer was a snort and a grimace. No, the campus wasn't like that at all. Not like the specter of the old James Bond movies, or the thrush of the Man from U.N.C.L.E. reruns on Nick at Night. Conspiracy theory depended on the ability of large numbers of people to keep their mouths shut, and as Mike had told him so many times, bad guys couldn't keep their mouths shut. There were no deaf and dumb people in federal prisons, Mike had told him many times, but criminals never quite figured that one out. The idiots. Even the people he was tracking had that problem, and they were supposedly smart and highly motivated. Or so they thought. But no, not even they were the bad guys of the movies. They needed to talk, and talking would be their downfall. He wondered which it was. Did people who did evil things need to brag, or did they need others to tell them that they were doing good in some perverse way upon which they all agreed? The guys he was looking at were Muslims, but there were other Muslims. He and his father both knew Prince Ali of Saudi Arabia, and he was a good guy. The guy who'd given his dad the sword from which he'd gotten his Secret Service codename, and he still stopped by the house at least once a year, because the Saudis, once you made friends with them, were the most loyal people in the world. Of course, it helped if you were an ex-president, or in his case, the son of a former president now making his own way in the black world. Damn, how will Dad react to this? Jack wondered. He's gonna have a cow. And Mom? A real hissy fit, That was good for a laugh as he turned left. But Mom didn't need to find out. The cover story would work for her,